Welcome to the podcast of The Diane Rehm Show, smart conversation and civil dialogue from WAMU and NPR in Washington.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the completely redesigned 300-horsepower MDX. More information is available at Acura.com.
For joining us, I'm Diane Rehm. Outside the headquarters of the CIA stands a statue of Nathan Hale. The Revolutionary War hero was one of the nation's first spies. Today, the U.S. spends billions of dollars on covert operations. But 9/11 showed the shortcomings of American intelligence operations. James Olson spent his career in the CIA's Directorate of Operations. In a new book, he presents 50 scenarios CIA field officers face almost every day, scenarios which present difficult moral and ethical choices. His book is titled Fair Play, The Moral Dilemmas of Spying. And James Olson joins me in the studio. Throughout the hour, we'll welcome your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Diane. It's very nice to be here.
Thanks for being here. Before we talk about your book, let's talk about a friend and former colleague of yours at Texas A&M University, incoming Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, who was sworn in this morning. What can you tell us about him that the public may not have heard yet?
Well, Bob's a good friend. We go back a long time, starting at the CIA, but also at the Bush School at Texas A&M. I'm a great admirer of his. I think he's a very independent thinker. I know he's a problem solver. He's a team builder. He's absolutely honest. He will not be bowled over by anybody in Washington. He's had very important jobs up here. And I think maybe what people don't truly realize about Bob is what a great people person he is. And I'm convinced he's going to be a soldier Secretary of Defense, which I think will be very nice for us, just as he was a student's president at Texas A&M.
How has he been at Texas A&M?
He's probably been the most popular president that anybody can remember down
Interesting.
There. I don't think he has any detractors. He made a tremendous impression on everybody down there for his sincerity, his commitment to the students, and his ability to build a first-class educational program.
Some people have accused Gates of being more concerned with pleasing his superiors than offering a truly critical assessment of what's going on, especially with regard to Iraq.
Well, that's certainly not the Bob Gates that I knew. I was in Soviet operations myself. I saw Bob's intelligence product. I never saw any indication that he was trying to curry favor with his superiors. I think that would be very uncharacteristic of him. And, of course, for an intelligence analyst, that would be the cardinal sin, to change intelligence analysis to suit any customer, including the President of the United States. I just don't think that that's a credible charge made against Bob.
So why do you think he was chosen? What do you assume or think his actions might be?
I think Bob was chosen because he is such a respected public servant. He's had very responsible jobs in Washington. He's worked with the military. Of course, he's got a strong background in the intelligence community. He's a person of integrity. I think he's also someone who can work on a bipartisan basis, and I think we desperately need that now. He has praise to me in our private conversations, members of both parties. I think he can really do a better job of his, from any of his predecessors, in putting together some kind of consensus and work toward a solution in Iraq.
How do you think he will relate to the report of the Iraq study group?
I think, of course, Bob was part of that. And so I think he is committed to the basic outlines. He's now in the administration. I don't think he feels bound by it, and certainly the administration in general does not. But he will look at it very closely. I'm sure he'll go out there very soon. He'll get
to Iraq.
To Iraq. He'll get ground truth. And then he will build his team, and I think he will move very decisively to implement whatever the recommendations are that that he and the president come up with.
Well, and that's the ultimate question, isn't it? Who do you think will influence whom? Will it be the president saying, this is how I want it, or will it be Bob Gates saying, Mr. President, this is how I believe it ought to be?
I think it's more likely to be the latter. I think the president chose Bob because he knows that he has a reputation for calling it the way it is. And I think and I hope the president is looking for some very honest, objective, hard-hitting advice, and Bob will give it to him.
James Olson, he's former chief of CIA counterintelligence. His new book is titled Fair Play: The Moral Dilemmas of Spying. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. How much approval, how much disapproval did you have from the CIA in writing this book?
I'm still bound by my secrecy agreement to the CIA.
How far does that secrecy agreement go?
For life.
What does it cover?
It covers anything we publish. It covers any public pronouncements we make in any forum. And so it's a very serious obligation that we commit ourselves to.
So how can I trust anything at all that you say or write?
Well, because I'm going to tell you the truth, and I'm not going to allow the CIA to dictate things that are false. And my book was reviewed in manuscript form by the CIA before anyone else saw it. And as you've probably seen in looking through the book, there were some things that were blacked out.
A fair number of things, as a matter of fact.
But I was surprised by how much they left in. I really thought that, given the sensitivities of some of the recent books that have come out, that they might have been even tougher in what they would allow in the print. I don't think they really hurt the thrust of what I wanted to say, or, most importantly to me, the portrayal of the reality of the world of spying.
What were the general areas most affected by the blackout?
The few blackouts, I think, were mostly related to things that are in the public domain, because I was very careful in writing the book of not crossing over into classified territory. But as they told me, that even though it's in the public domain, you're saying it with your background gives confirmation, gives validity to it. And in some cases, they weren't quite prepared to do that. One example you'll see is when I'm talking about the poisons that we've used for our L pills, our lethal pills. There was some sensitivity, even though there has been a great deal of public discussion about the kinds of poisons we've used. I think the CIA didn't want me to confirm some of that information.
Give us a general idea of what the CIA's counterintelligence area focuses on.
I love counterintelligence. For me, it's the most challenging of all the intelligence disciplines. And in short, Diane, it is just all the steps that we take as a country to counter what foreign intelligence services are doing against us, either in the United States or anywhere in the world. And so that is analyzing what foreign intelligence services are up to. It's trying to penetrate them so we can find out exactly what is going on. And it is protecting our secrets against their efforts to steal them from us.
And how would you characterize why intelligence missed 9/11?
Because it was just such an incredibly difficult target. You know, I think we had pieces of it. I don't think we had enough analytical power to put it all together. I certainly wish we had, and that's something that I believe needs to be corrected. I'm a strong advocate of analysis, and I think it's been undervalued over the years. I do believe that we put appropriate caveats on our 9/11 intelligence, and you know, no one feels this worse than we do. You know, our job in the CIA was to prevent things like this from happening, and we didn't get the job done. I was at our headquarters shortly after 9/11, and I've never seen our people more disheartened, more discouraged than they were, because they knew that they'd let the American people down. And it's a burden they're going to have to carry with them for a long time. And all we can do is resolve to do better the next time.
How was it, or how much did that lack of sharing of information play in the fact that the intelligence system broke down?
Right. There were bits and pieces, as you know, different places. The FBI had some, we had some. And much has been made of the fact that our two organizations didn't share the information, that there were turf battles. I think that's primarily a media creation. When you have so much information coming into the FBI and the CIA and the NSA and other U.S. intelligence agencies, like in any other bureaucracy, there are going to be times when the information doesn't always get where it needs to be as quickly as it should be. I think those are unintentional. I never saw any kind of a systemic failure in the process. We do need to do a better job of communicating, but it certainly wasn't a lack of goodwill or desire to cooperate with our sister services.
So from your point of view, the so-called turf battles that were reported are more fiction than fact?
They existed in the past. I certainly saw them at the first part of my career. But I was there, and I can tell you that today the cooperation is excellent. And if I ever saw any of my subordinates bad-mouthing the FBI or the military services, NSA, I cut it off right now.
James Olson, his new book titled Fair Play, The Moral Dilemmas of Spying. We'll take your calls, your questions, comments. Stay with us. And if you'd like to join us, call us on 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. James Olson is with me. His new book titled Fair Play, The Moral Dilemmas of Spying. He teaches courses on intelligence and national security at Texas A&M University. He spent his career in the CIA, rising to Chief of CIA Counterintelligence. He served overseas in Moscow, Vienna, and in Mexico City. While you were in the CIA, looking at the subtitle of your book, The Moral Dilemmas of Spying, did you or any of the agents that you were with deal with moral questions?
Well, we certainly had our own personal moral codes, but I do not recall any courses, any real discussions that we had on the morality or the ethics of what we were doing. I think back then it was just assumed that collecting intelligence was for the good of the country. It was kind of a case of our country right or wrong, and we really didn't hesitate in what we did. As I look back on it now, I'm a little bit surprised that we didn't stop and think and wonder about whether or not some of the techniques that have been traditionally used in intelligence were, in fact, in every case, morally appropriate or not.
So you talked earlier about lethal poisons. Was there a question that came up as to whether there was a sustaining morality behind the idea of not only using those kinds of pills, but indeed developing them?
No, I don't remember any ethical discussion whatsoever, any discussion about the morality. These pills were usually issued at the request of agents who were off on high, dangerous missions. And in some cases, they wanted the option of ending their lives to avoid certain torture and execution. And in some cases, to protect the secrets that they had that they did not want to divulge through torture.
Do you have any idea how many agents or spies actually use those?
I do, Diane, but I don't think I'm going to be able to say that.
So, a number.
I know that they've been issued, yes.
Issued, but also used.
We've had cases where they've been used.
And the question is, you know, how did you feel inside knowing that those were not only issued but used?
Well, I respect the decision that the person made at the time. These were people who were very courageously risking their lives on our behalf, and they knew what their fate was going to be. And I don't want to judge them after the fact or our willingness to give them that capability that they requested. It wouldn't have been a decision that I would have made personally, and I would not, in most cases, condone assisting in a suicide. But I can respect people who feel otherwise.
What about the use of those pills to end other people's lives?
Assassinations?
Yes.
No.
Never?
Not to my knowledge, no.
Not to your knowledge.
No.
But surely they had to have been developed not only for suicide measures.
Well, we have been prohibited from assassinations, of course, since the mid-1970s. And there were some plans to carry out U.S. government assassinations that are well known, particularly in the 1950s and 1960s. But I do not believe that any of those assassinations actually took place. I'm not privy to any actual assassinations that the CIA was involved in.
What about the kinds of calls we've heard for killing Osama bin Laden? How does that rank in the whole hierarchy of assassination or killing or doing away with or regime change, if you will?
Well, of course, that's a very hot topic at the moment. And a lot of people are asking us to revisit that whole issue of assassination. Much is in the definition, of course. Is killing a terrorist an actual assassination, or is it eliminating a combatant in a war-type situation? When I was writing the book and I was surveying the American people about whether or not they would condone an assassination of an Osama bin Laden or some other vicious terrorist, I found widespread support on the part of the American people. And you've seen that we have used predators with Hellfire missiles on them to attack terrorists, to kill terrorists overseas. We've done it in Yemen. We've done it in Pakistan. And there was no public outcry at the time. I found that a little bit strange because if, in fact, the American people are focused on whether or not we as a government are assassinating terrorists or not, you would have expected some kind of a discussion. but I don't think any of us recall any. It was just accepted that we are in a war against terrorism. If we can find terrorists, we take them out.
Do you think overall the Central Intelligence Agency has served as a value to the United States?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about that. My position, of course, is not totally unbiased because I spent my career there. But I think all American citizens should take some satisfaction in knowing that there are a lot of courageous men and women out there who are dedicating their lives to protecting all of us. And they're doing some amazing things. They're doing some dangerous things. And I know for a fact that we're much safer as a country because of what they do.
Now, think about what has been called your counterpart in what was the Soviet Union, the KGB, and now the FSB, I think.
Yes.
Always looked upon as an evil, deadly organization by people here in the United States. How do you believe the CIA is looked upon by people in other parts of the world in contrast or comparison to the KGB?
I think they look on us as kind of a quaint institution. Yes, and that we bother ourselves with moral issues because that is so contrary to their experience. The kind of debate that I'm trying to prompt in this book would not be taking place in Russia. It would not be taking place in Israel. It would not be taking place in China, where the view is that the intelligence services do whatever is in that country's interests. And the United States, I believe, is unique in that we do, in fact, have moral limits on what our intelligence services do.
Such as?
We do not assassinate. We do not torture. We do not do a lot of things, as you see in the book, that most other services do. We do not sexually entrap. And every other service that I know of does use seduction and sexual entrapment as part of the recruitment process.
How would you describe waterboarding?
Waterboarding is where a suspect is placed on an inclined board, generally with the head lower than the legs, and then the face is usually covered with cellophane or some other similar product. And then by applying water or sponges or wet cloths, the sensation of drowning is inflicted upon the subject. And it's a very, very horrible experience. And very few people, none to my knowledge, have been able to withstand that kind of technique when it's been used in an interrogation. According to press reports, it was waterboarding that broke Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of 9/11, when he was in our custody.
Was that torture in your mind?
I believe that it is an unacceptable practice. I'm not comfortable with waterboarding.
Does the CIA practice waterboarding?
No longer. It has been explicitly outlawed to my knowledge.
Since when?
Fairly recently, because it does inflict incredible psychological harm to the subject. It's no permanent damage, but it is a horrific process, and I think we have other interrogation techniques that we should resort to.
So the purpose of your book, then, is to take a look at the various techniques that the CIA employs and bring to them this question of morality and ethics. Wouldn't you say that's a little late for waterboarding?
Well, waterboarding, of course, could be reinstituted at any moment if the decision was made that it was in our national interest. Certainly, we need to interrogate our detainees.
Yes.
They are valuable sources of intelligence. Detainee interrogations save American lives. The purpose of the book is really to take the American people into this world. And I don't think they have any idea of what's really going on in the real world of espionage and covert action. And so these 50 scenarios are real life, and they take the reader into that world, and then after each scenario, I ask the reader, do you find this course of action morally acceptable or not?
Give me an example of one of these scenarios.
The one that comes immediately to mind is the first one in the book, and it's homosexual blackmail. And the scenario as I set it up is a Cuban intelligence officer, a DGI officer, working undercover in New York. FBI surveillance of him indicates that he is a practicing homosexual. In his culture and in his service, that would be grounds for dismissal, if not worse. And so the question is, would it be morally acceptable for the FBI and the CIA to blackmail him by threatening to disclose his homosexual practices with the photos and with the other evidence that we had to force him into a relationship with U.S. intelligence in which he would give us up their intelligence secrets?
And how did the public respond to those techniques?
With great difficulty, and I was struck by how people struggled over these moral issues. Certainly the United States has a high stake in knowing what Cuban intelligence is doing in the United States, but there were an awful lot of people who felt that sexual preference really should be off limits, that that's not a vulnerability that should be exploited for intelligence purposes. I would say that on that particular issue, people were roughly 50-50 on whether or not that would be an acceptable practice or not.
James Olson, his new book is titled Fair Play, The Moral Dilemmas of Spying. At 27 before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. First, let's go to Indianapolis. Good morning, T.A. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I have two points I'd like to cover. One involves great intelligence failures, and the other is on waterboarding, which you were just talking about. My opinion is that Mr. Gates presided over the greatest intelligence failure in the history of the world in that he failed to recognize that the Soviet bloc was a house of cards rather than this monolithic, totally cohesive entity that we faced. And, you know, there are the consequences of that are obvious. And in terms of waterboarding, I have to think, after having studied it and what it can produce and what the minimal impact on the detainee is, that I'm in favor of waterboarding, and that with what we're facing in terms of terrorists, and that there is the possibility that they could turn us into a third world country overnight, not using waterboarding might be considered immoral. And just to give you a background, a little bit, I co-founded a chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union at the university when I was a good deal younger. And I'd be delighted to hear what your guest has to say about
it. All right, sir. Thanks for calling on Robert Gates.
I think it's an overstatement, and I don't think it's historically accurate that the intelligence failure was really our inability to recognize that the Soviet Union was a house of cards, as our caller put it. It was no house of cards. Diane, they had missiles pointed at us. They were dedicated to destroying us and our way of life. It was a fight to for survival between two conflicting systems. And it certainly was a very serious matter of national security for us. And so I think dismissing it now, since we win, is pretty easy to do. But believe me, those of us who lived through it certainly considered that military threat, that ideological threat from the Soviet Union, real. And I think Bob called it basically right. The waterboarding issue is one that troubles me. As I said, it doesn't cause any permanent harm. And we definitely need to be able to break some of these subjects to get the intelligence that will save American lives. And so I think it's a close call. And I could see myself leaning one way or the other. I would hope, though, that we would devise other techniques that would be less horrific and would not need waterboarding. And that's our position at the moment, as I understand it.
Very interesting that you found there seems to be a greater revulsion on the part of Americans to torturing terrorists rather than killing them.
Right. Isn't that interesting? And that was pretty consistent from people of all different walks of life, political beliefs, religious views. There was a willingness in a majority of cases, I found, to assassinate terrorists. But when it came to torture short of death, there was a great deal of reluctance to engage in that kind of thing.
I'd be interested in terms of the Soviet Union for all of those years of the Cold War. There was communication between the Soviet Union and Washington, whether it was behind the scenes, whether it was that red phone in the White House. Do you believe that there is similar communication going on now between the administration or the CIA or the Department of Defense between the U.S. and Syria and Iran?
I don't know for a fact, of course, because I'm out of it, but I do believe that there is a high premium on communication, and I would be very surprised if we did not have channels of communication with Syria and Iraq and Syria and Iran and other adversaries.
James Olson, his new book is titled Fair Play, The Moral Dilemmas of Spying. We'll be back with more of your questions. Stay with us.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. Additional support for NPR comes from the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities, on the web at wkkf.org. And from the Annenberg Fund for Excellence in Communications and Education. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, ancient creepy crawly things come to life in the new film Night at the Museum. We'll talk with actor Ricky Gervais about his work on the big screen and the small screen. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And if you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Let's go now to San Antonio, Texas. Tom, your question for James Olson. Tom, are you there? Nope. Let's try Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and Stan. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Ms. Reams. I'm calling to take issue with your basic premise, more or less, that there is a big intelligence failure before 9/11. I think it was more a failure of the handling of the intelligence by the administration. I mean, if you look back at recent history, which it seems to be almost a Soviet-style erasure of recent history, especially with favors Mr. Clinton, but even the 9/11 report on the Millennium attacks, or Richard Clark's statements about how, you know, the Clinton administration had a cabinet-level task force that met every day, and he went down there and shook the trees, and, you know, there was stovepiping, there was institutional jealousy, you know, and there was all these problems, but they were overcome by leadership, you know, and better intentions, I would actually say, but the idea that we have to go ahead and restructure everything, go everything whenever. The problem is Mr. Bush couldn't drive a nail and blame the hammer.
What do you think, James Olson?
Well, I appreciate the vote of confidence in the intelligence community. I think probably the intelligence before 9/11 and before the invasion of Iraq was probably better than it's been given credit for. What we need to keep in mind, though, is that intelligence is never perfect. It's never total. It always is subject to analysis. And it is always going to be used by our customers, including the White House, as they see fit and as they interpret it. We don't dictate their courses of action. We provide as good and as objective intelligence as we can. Then they make their decisions accordingly. And everybody can second guess after the fact whether or not the intelligence justified the decisions they made. But that's really a policy call by the White House.
Here's an email from Keith. Does James Olson have any comment on the administration's censorship of an op-ed piece written by former CIA official Flint Leverett? Leverett's piece for the New York Times passed through the CIA's review process and was found acceptable for publication. But then the administration intervened and forced the CIA to censor the piece anyway. Is the White House politicizing the process of secrets review?
No, I have no inside knowledge of that incident. I do accept, though, the principle that the White House can overrule a CIA decision on what can and cannot be released. I think the White House is the ultimate decision maker on what goes to our national security interests and what doesn't. So I don't find it particularly alarming that the White House would decide that that op-ed piece, for whatever reason, on grounds of national security, should not be published.
Well, just for our listeners' information, Flint Leverett will be on this program on Wednesday morning. And let's go back to the phones to Phoenix, Arizona. Good morning, Charles. You're on the air.
Hello, Diane. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I was listening to the program this morning, and it seems almost like your guest is trying to present the CIA as sort of a benevolent, altruistic organization. And in the world of espionage, that just doesn't seem right. I wonder if you'd comment on that.
Yeah, I don't think benevolent is necessarily the image that I was trying to present. I would present the CIA as a group of professionals who are defending our country, who are doing their best to make the people aware of what the threats that we face are. We're public servants. We do what we do on behalf of the American people and in their name. I personally have never known finer people, more honorable people, more patriotic people than the people I was privileged to serve with in the CIA. And my wife, who was a CIA officer, I think feels the same way. I think the stereotypes of the CIA as lawbreakers or reckless or tramplers of civil liberties could not be farther from the truth. We obey U.S. law, and we swear an oath to the Constitution, and we do the best we can to serve the American people.
Here's a scenario from your book, number 9, concerning the operational use of journalists. And as you write this, you have relations between the U.S. and the Palestinians have deteriorated in the face of increased U.S. political and military support for Israel. The National Security Council asked the CIA to expand its intelligence collection capabilities against Palestinian and pro-Palestinian groups in the region. The CIA approaches Sylvie Selman, a Middle East correspondent for CNN, recruits her as an intelligence source. Selman is a Lebanese-born American citizen who's worked for CNN for 10 years. She speaks native Arabic. Selman has excellent contacts with the Palestinian National Authority and other groups. In return for a CIA salary of $250,000 a year, she agrees to provide the CIA with everything she learns from her sources. She will not slant her reporting in any way, but she will accept intelligence requirements from the CIA and will seek out contact with specific individuals at CIA direction. The CIA is confident this arrangement will be very helpful in obtaining information and insights on the Middle East that would not otherwise be available to the U.S. government. The U.S. National Security Advisor and the director of the CIA approved the operation. Now, this, I presume, is not using real names.
No, and this is hypothetical.
Hypothetical, but based perhaps on something that has been done.
Well, historically, there have been associations between the CIA and journalists for the benefit of the country. We are prohibited from most contacts with journalists, and so this would not be a real world situation today, but it could be. And there are an awful lot of people who think that because of the new threat we're facing, this particularly insidious enemy that is international terrorism, we should look again at some of the kinds of cover arrangements and operational arrangements that we no longer are using but might be able to use in the future.
What is the moral judgment to be made here?
The moral judgment is whether or not it would be appropriate to mix spying with journalism. And as you can see from the people that I showed that scenario to, they were mixed. There were people from CIA, there were journalists, and I would say roughly half of them thought that in certain cases it would be appropriate for a journalist voluntarily, with or without salary, and with salary in this case, but with or without salary, to share information with the CIA for the benefit of our country's security. Other people feel that that is just so contrary to the independence of our American press that it should be absolutely hands-off.
Here's an email from Michael. Please ask your guest to comment on the Northwoods Project. Was this a joint effort between the NSA, CIA, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff? Based on what I've read on the Northwoods Project, I have a very hard time believing anything our government has to say and fully understand why conspiracy theories spring to life around incidents like 9/11. First, explain for us the Northwoods Project.
Well, I'm not an expert on the Northwoods Project. As I recall, it was a proposal, and only a proposal, to instigate some uprisings, some demonstrations, and some violence in Cuba to justify a U.S. intervention. That plan was never realized. I think it was misguided. I think it was reckless. And I would have been very surprised if it ever would have become policy.
Let's go to Kent, Ohio. Good morning, Jim.
Yes, sir, Mr. Olson. Well, before I get to my question, I'd like to correct what you just said. Operation Northwoods was a plan by the Joint Chiefs of Staff to conduct acts of terrorism in this country, not in Cuba, but in this country, in order to blame Castro as a pretext to go to war on Cuba.
How do you know that, Jim?
Well, James Banford, one of your former guests wrote about it in his book, I think, The Puzzle Palace.
Do you contradict that, James Olson?
No, I think the caller is correct that the plan as it was drafted did include some activities, short of terrorism, as I recall, but some activities in the United States to build up a reaction against Cuba that would justify a reaction. It was a harebrained idea. It never was implemented. I don't think it really merits much discussion here.
But surely against the law.
It certainly would have been against the law.
Well, to follow up on that, I mean, Kennedy put a stop to it. He's the one who fired the Joint Chiefs and the CIA personnel who were involved in it, Alan Dulles and Richard Bissell and William Harvey, those guys who were involved in this plot, and that's probably why they killed him.
Why they killed the president?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, they were probably the same people who were going to do Operation Northwoods were involved in the assassination of our own president.
Well,
not to mention like Pinochet.
Jim, I think that does get to conspiracy theories regarding President Kennedy's assassination. And I know they're out there. They will always be out there forever and ever because the Warren Commission was filled with holes. I mean, let's face it. The Warren Commission report did not satisfy a great many people in terms of its reporting techniques, in terms of its ultimate conclusions. But I think, Jim, for you here to accuse the CIA of having been involved in the assassination is going a bit far. You also, I gather, want to ask about plutonium.
Yeah. That was my original question. I mean, do we use polonium as a poison? But I wanted to ask you more importantly than that is, do you know about the CIA's involvement in the assassination of Letelier, the Chilean exile here in this country?
All right.
I know the case, of course, but I discount any possibility that the CIA was directly involved in the assassination of Letelier in the United States. I think it's just another conspiracy theory that has no basis in fact.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I think, James Olson, you can hear very clearly that when you write a book about the CIA, and when you go around the country talking about the book, there is a fair amount of not only skepticism, but indeed hostility in regard to the work of the CIA. Why do you suppose that is?
Well, because the CIA has a lot of mystery associated with any secret organization does. And the CIA, to be honest, has been involved in some inappropriate activities.
Such as?
Iran-Contra, I think, was a shameful incident in our history. I think that
Bay of Pigs
was a disaster. It never should have been approved. But, Diane, I think we really need to focus on the fact that the CIA does not operate in a vacuum. It does not operate on its own. And I think the American people sometimes attribute things to us exclusively, whereas, in fact, in every case where we carry out a covert action, we have a signed finding in writing from the President of the United States, approved by the National Security Council.
That doesn't necessarily make it right, however.
It does not, but at least it's not the CIA off as a rogue elephant carrying out these operations on its own. We are carrying out the requests, the orders of the executive branch. And so if people find fault with what we do, I think they should also look at the presidents. Every president has used covert action without exception, regardless of party and regardless of ideology.
And to what extent was the White House involved in the attempt to assassinate Fidel Castro?
Well, that's well documented. There was a lot of pressure from the White House during the Kennedy administration to assassinate Fidel Castro, and we were criticized frequently by the White House for not moving quickly enough or getting the job done. That's a matter of public record.
So from your perspective overall, the CIA has done a good job.
I think we can be proud of what the CIA did. Certainly we have saved a lot of American lives. It was certainly to our advantage during the worst moments of the Cold War that our leaders were operating on the basis of hard facts, intelligence that we produced, rather than biases and fears and misperception about what the enemy was doing.
But why do you believe the intelligence regarding weapons of mass destruction, for example, in Iraq? Why do you think that that was not paid attention to?
Well, I think that there were caveats on that intelligence. And again, the White House can interpret intelligence as it sees fit. But certainly the intelligence should have been better. You know, we should have done a better job of pulling together all the different pieces that we had. And I wish we had. I think it would have made a lot of difference if we'd done a better job there.
And even the fact that the budget of the Central Intelligence Agency is not part of the public record, I think that also leads to a lot of questions in
sure.
people's minds. James Olson, his new book is titled Fair Play: The Moral Dilemmas of Spying. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Ann Adams, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg, with help from Elizabeth Terry. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, cassette and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.